Welcome back to Alphabet Scoop. This is episode 31. I guess we could call it Alphabet Spook.
We workshopped that all day, for the record.
Yeah, we were trying to find a way to make this like a Halloween show, but there's nothing, I don't know, there's nothing to talk about, really.
Yeah.
I guess we can start with Google and the couple of things they did.
Indeed. So, okay, sorry. Freezing tabs. Okay, so this week, well, last week, because of our new format, Google had the usual earnings call. And since the Pixel 3s were just announced, Pixel 3, Home Hub, Pixel 6, etc., the new products were reflected in the just reported earnings. But one investor asked Sundar about how Google sees the Pixel success 3 years later. And the question was, why does Sundar think that the Google's made by Google is more successful? And his answer was that everything is progressing well, that each year they're meeting the metrics and benchmarks. They're finally able to meet the early demand. So everything is ramping up, but according to him, the problems that they still have is first being able to build a supply and get everything out. And the second is the go-to-market strategy, which is basically like retail locations and getting in more countries and carriers as possible. And according to him, again, everything is going well.
Yeah, he kind of confirmed what I've been saying for a long time, was that, you know, they're mostly concerned with seeing growth year over year, and they're not really looking at it in terms of how quickly they're going to kill the iPhone, which is not going to happen, probably. Nope. But yeah, it was an interesting call. I didn't really get to listen to it, but I trust that you found it to be interesting.
Yep. There's always mountains of questions. And I do admit I sometimes fall asleep because there are a lot of numbers involved and whatnot. But
yeah,
sometimes they're consumer-focused questions that apply to us. So in other news, there was another interesting interview with The Verge involving Ivy Ross, which is Google's head of hardware design, and Rishi Chandra, which is head of the VP of Google Home and Nest. So they basically talked over design. There was another touching on the notch and why they made it. Basically, they thought they had enough space to include it, to include useful information to the left and right. So rather than do a thicker forehead, they did notch. But another interesting like factoid was how Ivy confirmed that internally Google designers called the Pixel considered not pink, sand. So that's why we saw some leaks referring to the new color sand. That totally pans out. But actually the most interesting thing that I found was the talk discussing phones and cases today. Everybody puts a case on their phone. Everybody loves cases. So Google's talking had this idea, what if they just made one color and they made a lot more cases?
I need to interrupt you first because I have a Note 8, a Pixel 2 XL, a Pixel 3, and an iPhone 10, and none of them have ever had a case on them at all.
Likewise.
So, likewise. I guess I'm the exception to the rule on that front. But on the Ivy Ross stuff, the most interesting thing to me was she was, I don't know, the notch question is a hard question for them to answer without admitting that they're a year or two behind on hardware engineering or design, I guess. It basically sounded like her rationale, the way she tried to frame it was, we could have had done another year of Pixel 2 XL, you know, and this is what you got instead, so you should be grateful. That's kind of how it came across to me. I don't think that the we needed space to fit in the two front facing cameras. Like that argument doesn't really hold weight. I mean, the argument, I guess their argument boils down to this is better than just having a huge top bezel, like, again, for a third, or yeah, I guess a third year. When, you know, the iPhone 10 is now a year old, and the iPhone 10 not only ditched the bottom bezel, Apple managed to cram so much stuff into a relatively small notch for how much stuff is in there. And so I feel like the iPhone, if we're looking at design of smartphones as a whole, I don't think the iPhone is the gold standard. But if we're looking at the way notches are being handled, I think the iPhone is the gold. I guess that's debatable now that the OnePlus 6T has been announced, and it's kind of what they did is all they did was put a tiny little front facing camera in that little notch, and they have a very, very slim bottom bezel. And so I guess from a looks standpoint, that kind of look is probably better than what Apple's doing. But I think in terms of finding a balance between the design looking nice and cramming a ton of tech into the notch, and making it have as much of a functional purpose as possible beyond just being a camera, I think Apple is the gold standard, or the iPhone 10 and the XS are basically the gold standard. And if we're just looking at notched designs, maybe you disagree, but I think that Google is, and a lot of companies are behind on this. I don't really know. I need to look into this. I need to look into what exactly is the technical constraint. Like, why was Apple able to do the wraparound display on the bottom and get rid of that bottom bezel like a year and or 2 years ahead of the entire Android space? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe the answer is out there. If it is, feel free to educate me. But that's kind of like if the Pixel 3 XL didn't have that bottom bezel, it would not be nearly as criticized, I don't think. I think it's the fact that it's a double compromise. Not only is the notch huge, they did a huge notch and they didn't even get rid of the bottom bezel like the iPhone 10 did 12 months ago. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the iPhone 10 was in development 12 months, 24 months before that. So, you know, there was probably a prototype iPhone 10 with a notch with no bottom bezel 2+ years ago, maybe 2 years ago. And, you know, if that's the case, it just makes everyone look so far behind. At least that's my take. And so all of Google's explanations mm-hmm. just seem silly. It's just like, no, the answer is you're behind. And Apple, and I think next year, maybe the year after, we're going to see them go even further and, you know, do designs like what some have mocked up of the Galaxy S10, which is like this, you know, like just the holes that are necessary in the display are going to be cut out, but there's not going to be, you know, a notch cut out. I don't know if anyone saw that tweet by MKBHD. Maybe I can't find it in time right now to bring it up, but you know, he showed, you know, what he's guessing the design progression of the iPhone 10 design will be and the slow eradication of the notch. And, you know, it just seems like Apple's a year or two ahead of everyone. What do you think?
Yeah, personally, I don't have a phone with a notch and I probably won't be getting one until next year. I don't mind thin, minimal top and bottom bezels. I really don't. I'll always pick that over a notch. So for me, personally speaking, I hope that Google continues having a small notchless phone in the style of the Pixel 3, or taking some inspiration from the Galaxy S9, S10 line, because I think that is that's a good enough design for now until somebody can make the next big jump to completely bezel-less screens.
Yeah, I don't know what the next big jump will be. To me, it seems like the next jump will be just like the notch slowly disappearing and ending with, I mean, I don't know about the technological limitations of how cameras could happen under the display. Like, I don't know. Like, the way I've seen mock-ups with the S10 basically show like little holes. Like, it's basically little holes in the OLED display where the cameras can just pop through. And it seems like that's going to be like the next few years, where it's just like the iPhone, Galaxy S10, whatever, like, are just going to slowly get rid of that, and we'll eventually have a bezel-less phone, one slab of metal or one slab of glass, you know, a display all the way around the edge with minimal bezel, smaller bezels than the iPhone 10 right now, and no notch, but that hardware still has to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it might not be a notch anymore, but, you know, I could see displays made where it just wraps around every aspect of that hardware. At least that's what it seems like to me, is where everything's going. And, you know, whatever. I'd rather have that than a notch.
Yeah, but, same. And in the meantime, if nobody can get to that point, I think companies should be inflicting notches on people. That's my stance personally.
Yeah, I don't know.
The Pixel 3 XL, I would have preferred if Google just stuck to the Pixel 2 XL design. If rather than copy Apple and other companies, just stick to their own thing. At the event, we and other publications pointed out there's no good justification for the notch yet. And honestly, I agree.
Yeah, I think that it came down to, you know, that binary decision of, do we just do another Pixel 2 XL again, or do we do the notch design? And I think, as silly and as, I don't know, dumb as this is, I think the Pixel 3 XL will sell more units because they went with the worst, quote unquote, design.
No, I agree. People want to follow. Mark wants to follow. People want the status symbol associated with the notch, however ridiculous it sounds. It's
right.
It's there, copying. But moving on to another point, what do you think about when Ivy mentioned the idea that Google like prototyped the idea of just having one color and multiple phone cases?
Well, I mean, I think with some phones, I mean, some phones are kind of sort of already doing that in a way. Like, I mean, there's not that much difference between having one color and having two colors. Like the iPhone 10 last year, for instance, was white or black. Those were your options. And, you know, everyone puts a case on it because the thing is solid glass. And so it makes no sense not to have a case, because the second you drop it one time, it's shattered. It looks like they fixed that with the iPhone XS and XS Max. Like, I saw, maybe it was Jerry Rig did a drop test video of the XS, and it stood like 10 drops without a single crack on the glass on front or back. And like, that just blew my mind. And I don't know if I don't know what the state of other glass phones are. Like, I don't know how the Pixel 3 XL, for instance, would stand up to that. If Jerry Rig hears this or watches this, feel free to test them side by side, because I'd be interested. But anyways, back to the question about colors and cases. I think that, you know, it's already a thing in for some phones. I mean, look at the OnePlus. Am I right to say the OnePlus 5T only comes in one color right now? Maybe I'm wrong. Or if not 5T, 6T. I'm probably wrong. I haven't been following that closely. But, you know, some phones only come in one color and people put cases on them, and that's fine. And I don't think that you know, Ivy making this point is really all that surprising, because I think if the phone came in a, I mean, look at the phones that we, I mean, I've got six phones on my desk right now. Phones have already gotten to the point where they look so the same. Like, they're all rectangles with, you know, a microphone on the top or bottom and a speaker on the top. And they're mostly bezel-less. Some of them have not, most of them have notches. You know, it's like phones are already so, you know, similar to each other, that why don't we just genericize it as much as we can, and make the unique parts of it be the case and how what you cover it with. I think there's really something to be said about how crazy fast. Dbrand, for instance, has grown. Like, Dbrand pushes millions of these skins. And, you know, like, obviously, they're a powerhouse brand and selling tons and tons of pieces of poly. I don't even know what kind of material those things are. But, you know, by the way, their margins on those must be crazy. Like, 95% margin. I think people will customize their phones and put cases on them anyway. So personally, I wouldn't care if the Pixel was only in one color. But, you know, she makes a good point that people have an emotional attachment to making that choice.
So moving on from her portion of the interview, just briefly, Rishi Chandra, head of Google Home and Nest, there was I guess it was minor controversy a few weeks ago of Google not using Android things for the Google Home Hub. Basically, his argument was that Google is much more familiar making a Google Cast devices, that they, as a company, have optimized and tuned for that platform, and they're at the point where they can really make fast hardware around that operating system of sorts. While all other OEMs, they're familiar with Android. They have the engineers already. They have the know-how on how to bring it up quickly. So I think that's a good explanation.
Yeah, I actually want to call out a 9to5 Google commenter, because a side story to this, a security researcher claimed this week that the Google Home Hub has a security flaw, which basically meant, you know, the simple version is that you could, if you're on the same network as the Google Home Hub, you could literally just do like one command. And I guess, what could you do? Like
reboot, I believe.
Reboot it. Yeah. Anyways, you know, there was a claim that, you know, the Home Hub is insecure, which Google came out and was like, yeah, this isn't really a problem. So it kind of made the security researcher, I don't know, it's kind of embarrassing for the security researcher, because he turned it into a big deal. And then it seems like it's really nothing. Or at least nothing of concern, not that it's not a security problem. But someone asked, a commenter on that article asked, isn't both the Cast platform and Android things created and maintained by Google, and therefore shouldn't Google be intimately familiar with both platforms? Granted, Cast is a couple years older than Android things, but still. And I think they kind of answered their own question with that. You know, the question is, if Google is just as, they're both Google's, you know, Android things and the Cast platform operating systems, I guess you could say, are, you know, they're Google's, they're both maintained and made by Google. So why would this argument that one is, they're more familiar with one over the other be valid? And I think the answer to that, is one, yes, the Cast platform has been around longer. I think, has it?
Yes.
I think it's been around like a couple years longer. And then the other thing is this is an aspect I think that might have been missed, was they've already launched consumer products with the Cast platform, many consumer products actually. You know, going all the way back to the Chromecast, more recently, you know, Google Home, and 2 years ago, Google Home, and, you know, Google Home Max and Google Home Mini. So like that, they have more experience shipping products running the Cast platform. And so it makes sense that they would continue to do that. If it's just as easy to build on top of the Cast platform as it would be to put Android things on the Home Hub, it makes sense that they would keep using the Cast platform. Do you have any more thoughts on that?
Nope. Much ado about nothing.
Yeah, in my opinion. I think so too.
You want to touch on how you've been using your Home Hub since the review?
Yes. So one thing I've been using it for more, which I kind of underappreciated during my 4-day review period, thanks a lot, Google, was the photo frame stuff. And we talked about this a little bit already, but the automatically generated, you know, Google Photos albums, I have those running on it 24/7 now in the kitchen, which is nice. I've used it primarily the same way I've always used a Google Home, which is like I play music on it and I set timers on it. And that's like 75% of the things I do with it. However, I've noticed in the last week or so that I use it for the home view stuff all the time now because it's so much easier. So I didn't appreciate this before, but so like having all these different things and having them all have different apps, like having, you know, the Nest app for controlling the Nest cameras, the Philips Hue app for controlling the Hue light bulbs, having that all in different places on your phone is just a hassle. And I didn't appreciate how nice it would be to not only have home view itself, but have access to it, like just a swipe away anytime. Like, you know, for instance, this past weekend, the light was on in my living room and I was going to bed and my phone was already in the bedroom charging. Like, you know, not that far. I mean, this is a first world problem, but you know, it was pretty far across the house. And I thought like, okay, I need to turn off this Philips Hue light. I had these other Philips Hue lights on in the office too. So I was like, okay, so I can go, I stood up and I was like, I can go to each of these lights and turn them off manually, which you can't really do very easily with the Hue light strip, for example. So I would have to do the like physical switch, or I could go back to my room, like all the way back to my room and pick up my phone and then find the home app or one of the other two, or find the Philips Hue app, you know, and go in and, you know, whatever, find that. Or on my way to the bedroom, I can walk by the home hub, swipe down, turn off all, and I just walk to the bedroom. So that was like one of those like little conveniences where I didn't realize how nice it is to have just like that home control right there at your fingertips. And it's just another one of those things where it's like, you know, digging for apps and then digging in apps is just annoying. And yeah. So it's nice. It's really nice. That's the biggest things that I've noticed. But other than that, yeah, I cook a lot. So I set a lot of timers.
Dedicated hardware controls and like physical buttons and those kinds of things, they really do work. And there's a reason why if you make it cheap enough, people will want to put them everywhere.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I want a home hub that I can mount in the wall, you know, like a Nest thermostat, but I want to mount it like, you know, in my hallway or whatever. Yeah. I could have like two or three of those in my house and it would be awesome.
It's honestly funny how like, I don't know, 10 years ago when the first smart homes are coming up, people had these large gigantic tablets to control these super advanced systems, like Bill Gates's house, for example.
Right.
I forgot what that was about, what the exact specifics were, but he had a whole system to control it. And he had something like, if you had a bracelet, the house would know who you were, or like just turn on the lights automatically as you step in the room or something like that. Something complex. But now that technology, you know, a decade or maybe less, has just come down to everyone.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. It kind of went full circle. You know, at first I think the primitive smart homes were all controlled with a hub of sorts. I think a lot of times when you see movies that have like smart homes, like from like the 90s and stuff, like sci-fi type stuff, they're always controlled by some kind of panel on the wall or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like a central hub control panel or whatever. And then all the smart home stuff for the last 5 years has been coming out, you know, and actually starting to gain traction. Like Philips Hue's been around a while now, and Nest, obviously, you know, things like piece by piece, smart home stuff has been really in like becoming popular with consumers. And in the meantime, everything has been pretty much controlled with various apps, unless it was HomeKit compatible, in which case for like the last, how long has HomeKit been around? Like 2 years? 3 years, maybe. You know, you could control it through the Home app on iOS, which actually the Home app didn't come until after HomeKit was firstly announced. So, you know, it kind of came full circle where it was like, you know, for a while we were controlling all of our smart home stuff with 10 different apps for each platform. And now Google and Apple both are putting it all in one place. And so we can all, it's been so nice. I'm just waiting for it to flesh out more. For instance, like the Google Home app on the phone cannot control Philips Hue colors, whereas Home View on the Home Hub can, which I don't know why. But yeah, that's one of those little, like, I don't know. Just, I don't know. Maybe that's a Philips decision, not a Google decision, but it'll be nice. It'll be nice when everything can be controlled from one place or two places. You get to pick home app on iOS or Google Home app.
So one more thing about the Home Hub that I've observed is I want to put it on my desk. I want to put it on my like working desk to have an always a gigantic clock always available to me and for quick music controls. But so much that I want to pair a Bluetooth headset to the Home Hub. It sounds ridiculous, but I like the idea of having like a dedicated place I can always go for music.
Yeah, I that's one of the reasons I have a huge Dell, not Dell, is it Dell? Yeah, I have a huge Dell, white, like super widescreen monitor, and I have my Spotify like docked to the, like one third of the display is like, I dock Spotify there just 24/7. And I just, that's how I keep my music always on tap. But yeah, that's a good idea. I haven't thought about just having us, you know, music controls tap away at all times. Pretty nice. I've really enjoyed another thing I've been doing is I'm home all day alone pretty much. And so I have a music, I created a group in the Google Home app of all the Google Homes, and I have a mini in the bedroom. I have a standard in this back bathroom. I have a mini in this office. I have the Home Hub in the kitchen, and I have a mini in the living room. And I have a Max in the dining room. So I have six Google Homes, and it's been fun playing like music on all six of them at the same time throughout the whole house whenever I'm home alone.
Yeah, and just walking like, through.
Just walking through the house and full volume. Like,
yeah. It's crazy how like tiny things seem stupidly futuristic.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Synced audio. We're finally there. Almost.
It's pretty, actually, I haven't noticed anything like in terms of like lag or, you know, discrepancy between them. It's solid. The thing I notice is that when I'm in the dining room with the Home Max, it sounds really good. And when I come in here and I'm listening on the Home Mini, it sounds really bad. So, I mean, I'm waiting for multi-room audio to come to the Chromecast. Because I've got like five Chromecasts too. And if I plug one into every device in the home that has an HDMI port, which is I've got a couple TVs, you know, a monitor here in the office. If I plug one of those into every device and hook all of those up to Bluetooth speakers, then we like that I could get up to like 10 speakers playing at the same time in the house. So yeah. Excited for that. I use Broadcast too. That's another thing. I found myself using Broadcast a lot more than usual the last few months. You know,
in I'll the just cons, like another thing that used to be limited to the rich.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, intercoms. Yeah, I didn't think about that. It used to be something you had to have professionally installed in the wall. It's now nice. You know, I'm in the kitchen. I can broadcast to my wife who's on the opposite side of the house. Now, it would be cool. I don't know if you can. Can you broadcast to a specific home, like broadcast to insert home name? Can you do that yet? I haven't tested it. If you can't, that would be cool. Cool feature to feature request for Google.
I see no reason why it shouldn't, but since they know you can. They know rooms and names of devices, but I don't think that's a feature currently.
Yeah. Another thing on Google Home, they really need to get their act together on the Google Home app. It is just, it's just so confusing to me.
Okay.
Endless menus.
Any of the media. Too many tabs. One, nobody wants the media browsing tabs. Everybody just lives in the first one where the list of devices are available.
Yeah, I agree with that. My bigger thing is like digging through the settings. Like the settings is just It got better with the redesign, the recent redesign of the assistant settings page, but it's just, there's so much and it's like impossible to find like what it is you're looking for. Another thing is there's a difference in the assistant or in the app in the settings between the name. So like what gets confusing is, and I think this is a problem that almost all average users have if they're not careful, is that they will name, you know, the Google Home something, and then it, in the assistant settings, they, you also choose a location for it, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a name and a location. So in my case, a few weeks ago, I had a home that I recently moved. And so I had homes that were labeled, like the home itself was called kitchen, and then it was in the living room. And so it's like, you know, you have to go digging for that setting to make sure everything is lined up, if that makes sense. It just seems like there's got to be a better way to have cohesive, like, naming of Google Homes. Because it's like,
actually, there's a tie-in with iRobot today. So Google and iRobot, oh, yeah, the company behind Roombas, announced this partnership where, so the Roombas, they can detect presence. They have a basic low-res camera and other sensors on the latest model that can map out your room. So Google and iRobot are partnering so that one day your rooms could automatically be labeled, and when you place smart home devices, they'll automatically know where they are in the context of your house. And so just further automating everything and making it smarter and just more working together. And it's super brilliant, actually, having the Roombas mapping data help build an idea of where everything is in physical space. There are going to be privacy concerns. I'm 100% sure of that. But the use you're getting out of that could be game-changing almost.
Yeah, it could also, I feel like the Roomba could also theoretically determine the wireless signals that are coming from various other hardware, mm-hmm, and the strength of those wireless signals, and could determine which devices are in which room just purely based on their wireless connections, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know, like Bluetooth, for instance, like, yeah,
they all broadcast something.
So it could see, like, not only could the Roomba tell which stuff is in what room, it could also tell theoretically where in the room each product is. You know, I mean, this kind of becomes a problem already with Google Home. If you have two Google Homes in the living room and you say, hot word, play something in the living room, it doesn't know what to do with that. I don't think it, as of now, I don't think it plays on both. It just picks one.
Closest to you.
So it doesn't seem like that. Like that is confusing, I think, to the end user. And it would be cool. I don't know. It would be really cool if we get to a point where the natural language processing is so good that you could talk to Google Home the same way you would to a person. Like hot word, play something on the speaker that's next to the TV, if that makes sense. Like, you could say that very specifically, and because, you know, the Roomba knows where in your room, theoretically, the product is, it could know which speaker to play on, if that makes sense. That's probably pretty far down the line, but I don't think that's too far-fetched for it, yeah, to, you know, have a pretty good map of everything.
Location awareness is an important thing.
Yeah, for sure.
If you want to touch on Apple, the Apple's announcements in regards to the Pixel Slate.
Yeah, so this week was Apple's event in New York. Interestingly, a little side note, before they kicked off the event, they had a big Apple Heart NY sign. And I know that everyone does a little variance of the...
Everyone
does like a Heart NY thing, but it in context of Google doing that just a month ago, it was funny. So I guess what they did was they announced the new MacBook Air, which I actually think the way I've been thinking about the new MacBook Air is that it is the second generation MacBook.
Oh, absolutely.
Like that's how I've been seeing it. Like, it's the second gen MacBook that they made however many years ago now, at a better price and with better features. And they just put the MacBook Air branding on it for obvious reasons, because MacBook Air branding is really strong. They also announced new iPads, new iPad Pro 11-inch now. It's an 11-inch device up from 10.5, right? Mm-hmm. And the 12.9-inch iPad Pro, which the smaller version now is, it's a smaller, no, it's a smaller footprint, and it's a bigger, no, or it's the same footprint, sorry, same footprint, bigger screen. The larger one is a same screen, smaller footprint. So yeah, those are both pretty interesting. And then what was the other Mac announcement? Mini. Oh yeah, the Mac Mini. I want one for my office, but yeah, it's gonna have to wait. Anyways, I guess the iPad Pro is probably the most important in context of what Google announced earlier this month. I can't say last month yet because today's October 31st. But the iPad Pro is, I feel like, I don't know.
If hardware, hands down. Okay, let's just get that out of the way. The hardware, they win, obviously.
Yes. Yeah. It's a no contest on the hardware. I mean, in terms of even if you just look at how much better Apple's silicon is versus, you know, what these Intel chips that Google's using, it's just not even like, it's not even the same ballpark. That's one thing. I guess what you have to do is you have to look at the value of the Pixel slate at $799 versus the entry level iPad Pro at the entry level 11-inch iPad Pro.
And
the thing is, okay, so yes. So is it the M3 model that
it would be competing. It would be competing with an M3 model.
Right. So it's a step up. It's a step up from the Celeron. But this, because the Celeron's $599, and then the next one up is one up the $799 M3. So yeah, that was the one that we actually got to see at the event. So the $799 M3, with 8 gigs of RAM. Talking about the RAM is kind of pointless almost.
I disagree.
Because I can almost guarantee you that the entry level iPad Pro in terms of multitasking is going to do better with less RAM.
Because it's the operating is entirely different. But in the context of the Chrome OS, more RAM the better.
Oh yeah, for sure, absolutely, no argument there.
I have the specs up here. So for $799 entry. Gets you an M3 processor with 8 gigs of RAM and 64 gigs of storage.
Right. I just feel like, okay, let's talk about what these products actually are. Like, I think they're kind of for different people. If you take these two $799 products, I don't think either one is like a crazy better value, if that makes sense. I would probably lean toward the iPad Pro being a better value, but I don't think it's like incredibly a better value. I just think it's different more than it's a better value, if that makes sense.
And I think it's a better value for most people, because the way I'm viewing this is from an operating standpoint. Chrome OS can do a lot now. It can do Linux apps, it can do Android apps, and it can maybe do Windows one day in the future. But at the end of the day, this is something that I don't know, but at the end of the day, are people more comfortable with the Chrome web apps, the Chrome browser where they do their work, where they've long done their work with Google Docs, Google Drive, or would they prefer a better tablet experience, an optimized tablet experience where Google Docs for iOS, Google Drive for iOS is available?
Yeah, I think if the work that you're doing is primarily on the web, it would be my opinion that the web browsing experience on the Pixel Slate is probably going to be better than the strict web browsing experience on the iPad Pro. But there are, you know, ups and downs. I mean, the iPad app store is chock full of really, really great apps ranging in price from $5 to $10. There's so many really, really good utilities that were made for the iPad and for the bigger screen. And they're all really, really good. A lot of them are really good.
Touch and optimized is the key.
Yeah. And not only touch optimized, but also Apple Pencil optimized. And Google tried to, you know, they tried to start working on that last year with the Pixelbook and the introduction of the Pixelbook Pen. And, you know, they partnered with some app developers here and there. But I don't think that library is anywhere close. Like, I think in terms of Pixelbook apps that are optimized for the Pixelbook and the Pixelbook Pen, there might be 10. You know, like literally you can count them on your hands, how many good apps that are optimized for that device. And on the iPad, there are thousands. And so from that standpoint, the iPad's a clear better value. It's more, I don't know, like it's more expensive in some ways, like, you know, the Pixelbook Pen, or not the Pixelbook Pen, the Apple Pencil is $30 more expensive than it was last year. You have to buy a whole new one this year if you are upgrading from a previous Apple Pencil and the previous generation iPad Pro, which is annoying. But I mean, they also thought about a lot of things that are just really nice. Like the magnetic charging of the new Apple Pencil is really nice. The fact that it has USB-C finally on an iPad is one thing that we can now say is not a con, for instance. You know, it was easier to say, okay, the Pixelbook Slate, the Pixel Slate, we could have said has a USB-C port, and so we could have used that as a, you know, as an advantage, but, or two USB-C ports, I should say. You know, better compatibility with peripherals. But, you know, now the iPad Pro has the USB-C port, and what that USB-C port can do on a practical level will probably only increase over the next couple of years in terms of connecting to external stuff. I don't know what other aspects. I mean, the display is probably nicer at $799. The $799 iPad Pro probably has a better display, or like not nicer quality display. The Pixel Slate would be getting you a bigger size at that price. Mm-hmm. At that $799 price, you'd be getting what is it for a Pixel Slate again? 12.9. I think so. I think it's 12.9, right?
It is.
We should know.
12.3. 12.3.
Okay, right. 12.3. So yeah, you're getting at $799. You'd be getting the 12.3 Pixel Slate display, which is
with bezels, a really good
display, but with the, you know, the less modern looking design. I think the new rounded corners and the iPhone 10-ish look of the iPad Pro is better.
I remember in October when Google was excited that the 7mm tablet was the thinnest around.
Yes. Yeah. Google mentioned before the Pixel Slate was announced that they were bragging on it having the smallest bezels of any mainstream tablet. And that ended real quick. Another thing is the actual fluidity and the usability of the OS. Based on our initial impression of the Pixel Slate, Google is struggling with that really bad. And maybe that will change because they obviously haven't sent out review units yet, probably for a reason. I would guess, based on my touching it at the event earlier this month, there's a reason that there's no review unit besides it being delayed, like the launch itself being delayed. I think there's a reason we don't have units yet because I think it probably sucks.
Still optimizing. They're still optimizing. But from a broader experience, okay, so there's like optimizations, but beyond that, are people, again, this goes back to my discussion, are people more familiar with an apps model, with a standalone dedicated apps model, or the web? Or will they appreciate having a full web browser? is that more familiar to them than having to have a dozen different productivity apps on their device to get the same experience? Or would they rather prefer everything in one tab? Because people do understand the concept of tabs very well.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a definite distinction there. And I think a lot of our productivity for a lot of people has moved to the web, you know, like, if I owned an iPad Pro 12.9 right now, if I bought it, for my job working in WordPress, I would not use the iOS tablet iPad WordPress app. I would use it in Safari because it's just so much better on the web, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
So, you know, like just one example, but I think a lot of cases are like that. Another thing is the difference, I think, between the two devices is that, like you said, one is primarily an app-based model, and it's, you know, you're swiping between a lot of full-screen apps, and there is, you know, multitasking in the latest versions of iOS. You know, Apple's gotten way better in that department in the last couple of years. But it's not on Chrome OS and on the Pixel Slate. It's primarily a windowed model, and you're actually using Android apps that are not optimized for a tablet in Windows, like not in Windows OS, but like in, you're using windowed Android apps. So that's just a primary difference is, do you want really well built full screen iPad apps, or do you want to use the apps that you're familiar with from your phone, from the Play Store, in windowed form on the Pixel Slate? Plus your usual web browser. It's like that. That's the other, you know, the option. And there is the web browser option in on the iPad too.
But I would argue that Safari desktops, that iOS Safari is not desktop Safari.
Right, and Chrome browser on iOS is not fully powered Chrome.
Yeah.
So it's not really Chrome at all, is it? Is Chrome OS on or is Chrome browser on iOS? It's still WebKit.
Yeah, it's using the iOS rendering engine.
It's crazy that Apple still hasn't opened that door.
Yeah.
And so, I think for me, in terms of, here's what I want. My dream device is the OS of the Pixel Slate on the hardware of the iPad Pro. Yes. I think that's what I want.
Historically, that's what people at the same level of hardware on the OS they want on the best, on the objectively the best hardware available. That's long-run dream. But again, like we've seen with the Pixel, they're getting really good hardware on the phones, like three generations. The first Pixel to the third Pixel is a huge jump. But while we might see that same jump in hardware on tablets, not as many people are buying tablets. And is that investment opportunity that, can Google reasonably invest that much into bringing up their tablet hardware?
Yeah. Do we think there's going to be a Pixel Slate 2 in 2 years or even in a year? I definitely know in a year, I think, because
2 year cycles historically.
You can almost feel Google's hardware just struggling, if that makes sense. Like struggling to keep up with Microsoft and Apple.
Yes, Microsoft is something.
That's a whole other thing, but they're not really selling much. I mean, they're kind of like in the same boat as Google, where it's like they've got really good hardware and they've got really good products that they're offering. But in terms of actual sales, Microsoft's first party hardware is just not doing so well. How many Surface books have you seen in the wild in the last year? Less than five?
Maybe. It's definitely more generic Windows laptops, always.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've seen probably three or four Surface Books in the wild in the last year. And I've seen less Pixel Books. Well, actually, I've seen more Pixel Books because I've been at Google events. But in my normal life, I don't ever see a Pixel Book at a coffee shop, ever.
I see $200 Chromebooks all the time.
Yeah, $200 Chromebooks, and I see lots of MacBooks of various generations. So Yeah, I mean, it's very obvious that, just like the slide that Apple showed, they showed iPad sales compared to notebook sales of every other manufacturer, and the only manufacturer that's anywhere close is HP. And they're selling Windows laptops and, I guess, Chromebooks. I don't know how that data was calculated. It might be Chromebooks and Windows laptops combined.
Yeah, PCs in general.
Yeah. I think that pretty much wraps up the conversation. I think in terms of sheer hardware, the conclusion is iPad Pro is very clearly a better value. In terms of the overall experience that you're getting, assuming Google really optimizes Chrome OS and fixes...
Which I think they will.
The stuff that we saw at the event. And assuming the software is like smooth as butter, as it should be on that hardware, then the M3 Pixel Slate, you know, you're not getting nearly as much bang for your buck in terms of hardware, but... You know, it's an alternative. I don't know if it's better for most people. Probably not. If I'm honest, I think the iPad Pro is probably better for most people than the Pixel Slate at that price. Sucks to say that, but I think that's where we are right now.
I think there are enough Chrome OS users out there that they might appreciate the premium hardware. But the question is whether they will get premium hardware from Google or whether they'll buy like expensive hardware made by HP and Lenovo and Dell and those companies. Well, not Dell, but
yeah, sure.
You get my point. But yeah, so it'll be an interesting review. We have one more review from Made by Google 2018, and the competition just got very interesting yesterday from Apple.
Yeah, it's really gonna make. I think it's gonna put a dark shadow on all the Pixel Slate reviews.
Yeah.
If I were to guess the average score that's going to be coming out for this thing, it's going to be like 7. You know, it's going to be like, this is good, but it's not like...
7 is such a non-committal score. It's like, it's not bad enough, but it's not that good. Like, you'll be fine using it. So, 7.
Yeah, it's like, if you buy this, you will not cry.
Yeah, you'll maybe have a good time. And
yeah. You won't wish that you bought the alternative that much, but you might a little. that's the seven out of 10 score.
Yeah, indeed.
But yeah, I don't know. There wasn't really that much to talk about today. It was a pretty scattered week. There was no real obvious, like really important news. Red Hydrogen 1 was like a bomb, hilariously. What's your thing?
I want to hear a tight 2 minutes on the fingerprint sensor on the OnePlus 6T from you. A tight 2 minute argument from you.
Okay, so I had a tweet storm earlier this week, so you probably already saw that. Some people, anyone who's watching this, probably already saw my tweets. But I think it's a fad. I think fingerprint sensors would have been nice like 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that as hard as they were to get right, like they've been in development. I mean, there's been rumors of companies working on them for half a decade. So it's like, you know, these have been a very intense engineering hurdle. One that, you know, that Apple only in the last year or two was able to, you know, Apple, you know, with all of its hardware engineering prowess, was only able to, you know, around the time of the iPhone X, finally like make progress in. Obviously they didn't do it in the iPhone 10 for obvious reasons, but you know, my point is it took a long time and a lot of effort to build this tech, and it's finally here. And I think personally, as someone who 50-50s between an iPhone 10 and a Pixel 3 XL now, I think that facial recognition is going to be what everything moves to in the next 2 years. If I were to guess right now, I think that the in-screen fingerprint sensor is going to go just as fast as it came, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think you had an interesting idea
about instant verification, always your phone always knowing if it's you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think people put this in a box of like fingerprint versus face recognition, because I mean, that was the whole conversation last year of like Apple, after many, many years of doing Touch ID, just saying, nah, we don't need Touch ID. We're going to do Face ID instead, which was a bold move. You know, early prototypes, I don't know if anyone remembers, but early prototypes of the iPhone X showed like a fingerprint sensor on the back. And more potential. I think that was something they considered, like doing both or just doing the fingerprint sensor, Touch ID on the back, rather than if like it was kind of the backup plan. It's like if Face ID doesn't work out for whatever reason, we'll have the Touch ID. Anyways, it was put in this box of like Touch ID versus Face ID or fingerprint versus facial recognition. And I think the picture is bigger than that. I think that what's really happening is that at a fundamental level, facial recognition makes more sense than fingerprints. I think what we're moving to is like passive security in the sense that like every device we interact with, whether it be our laptop, I'm looking at a camera right now on my MacBook, for instance. Every device we interact with is going to authenticate us and provide unique experiences based on who we are and which user is using them. And it makes a lot more sense to do that with a face than it does to do with a finger. If you want to make it as passive as possible, right now, Face ID on the iPhone, for instance, is not really that passive because it's still an intentional action. You still have to be. You have to make sure that your face is fully visible, and that's one of the main complaints is that it's not super seamless. Like you actually have to make sure that you have your eyes open. You have to, you know, like it's kind of, you have to be intentional about it, which is good. But I think like, I don't know, it just seems like all the devices in our life are probably going to move toward being super hyper personalized and knowing who's using them, including, I mean, I could see this applying to the Home Hub, for instance. Like we already know that Google is doing, what's it called? Voice match. Yeah, they're doing voice match to give you personalized results based on which person is interacting with them. And like in the Home Hub's case, I could see the Home Hub having a camera or a facial recognition, maybe not a camera, because obviously they took a stand against that this year. But, you know, I could see them having, you know, a infrared based, you know, face recognition security feature that does much the same. And I think a lot of devices in our life are going to all move that way. I mean, a lot of Windows laptops already do facial recognition. It's not as technologically advanced as Face ID, but it's been proven out to be a quick, easy, and useful way of logging into your computer that doesn't involve adding specific touch or fingerprint hardware. Fingerprint hardware, by the way, has been around on Windows laptops for like 10 years or more. And the early versions were garbage.
Oh, yes, they were. The early phone ones were very bad. It was like a Moto Axion something. I had a crazy nostalgia. But I remember the Atrix on my Motorola that had that insane dock setup.
Yeah.
Yeah, that had a very bad sensor. Very bad.
But anyways, I think that like, I don't know, it just seems obvious to me that face security has very significant benefits. It's harder to crack for one. I mean, if done right, it's harder to crack. You know, some versions have been easy to trick with, you know, photos of a face or whatever, but at least looking at Apple's version, you know, it's far more secure than fingerprint. And I don't know. It just seems like everything's going to go that way. So the way this loops back to the in-screen fingerprint is that it seems like it's kind of a gimmick, because in the short term, it makes the back of the phone look nicer because you get rid of that little bump. And I guess, I don't know, is that the only benefit? It's actually slower in most cases. I think that's the only benefit, really. It makes the phone look nicer. And so it's like all this engineering effort for a worse technology that only provides aesthetic benefits. It seems like inevitable that the objectively better technology, I think, I can't think of a single way in which Apple's implementation of face face-based security is worse than fingerprint, except for, I mean, right now it's got a disadvantage with speed, but that's something that can be overcome with time. I guess there's, if you're like, I don't know, I've had personal experiences like laying in bed and like having a blanket partly cover your face, and like, you know, like there's physical barrier limitations, but even that is something that can obviously be overcome, because we've seen, I mean, Face ID works with glasses on perfectly fine, for instance, and that is a physical barrier. And so I could see, you know, a future version of Face ID being able to look at just half of your face and just as securely authenticate that it's you, for instance. I mean, that might be down the line, but I think all these disadvantages that has today are easily overcome with time. And so, I don't know, just seems dumb that Huawei and OnePlus and yada yada are doing this, and it's kind of like doing the notch to me. It's like, this is not better. It's not objectively better in any way. It's just a trend. So in the long term, I think what is objectively better will win out. So you asked for 2 minutes, I gave you seven. That's yeah. My take on in-screen fingerprints. So, yeah, I think that pretty much rounds out the show. We don't really have that much more. There's not really anything exciting that happened this week, but maybe there will be next week. So I think we're losing your audio, but the show's over anyway. So I'll just close it out. I guess until next week's show, you can tune into Alphabet Scoop here every week. We record this podcast every Wednesday live on YouTube and publish every Wednesday afternoon or Thursday morning. You can find us on all your favorite podcasting platforms such as iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, Google Play, and you can also listen over at 95google.com directly. Thanks for tuning in as always, and thanks to Abra for joining me, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.